Okay, this is going to be my third and final video on my recent spat with the post-Keynesians and their claim that nominal price rigidity invalidates standard price theory. In plain English, in the real world, some companies don't change their prices very often, and so this supposedly presents a problem for the idea that prices reflect the relationship between supply and demand, and an even bigger one for the idea that prices coordinate market activity. If you missed the other two parts, in part one, I argued that using real data from Coca-Cola from the 1920s and the 1930s, that companies that pursue a strategy of fixing the price at a given number are still subject to price-related fluctuations in demand when you take real money prices into consideration. Demand tends to follow inflation or deflation. In part two, I argued that the post-Keynesians don't understand that price theory only explains the whole market and does not predict the behavior of individual firms. The post-Keynesians, in short, are committing the classic schoolboy error of confusing individual decisions with market trends. Now, my interlocutors have been upset that I haven't actually addressed the empirical evidence with which they've been spamming me. One of these papers, it turns out, was a simulation based on a mathematical model, the results of which the authors freely admitted are, quote, only valid within the theoretical framework that we have considered here. I'll leave that one there then. Most of the other papers were surveys based on asking a few hundred people from big companies about their pricing strategies. Now, before I continue, I just want to touch on methodology. Generally, I am extremely irritated by mathematical simulations or by surveys to explain economic reality. As long-time viewers of this channel will know, I am a fan of hard data as seen in revealed preferences. That is, actual real-world sales or stuff like migration data. We all know the difference between stated preference and revealed preference. J.K. Rowling's stated preference is that we should accept as many refugees as possible. Her revealed preference is to live in a walled-off mansion in a 97% white area, as many people pointed out a couple of years ago. You can see why revealed preference is the better data point. But there are other reasons for preferring hard data, like actual sales, to soft data, like surveys. One of the most widely cited papers ever on minimum wage was Card and Kruger in 1994. Their methodology in that paper was to ask fast food firms who were operating in Philadelphia and New Jersey before and after a minimum wage hike had been passed. And they asked those companies, had it hurt business or did they have to lay anyone off? Does anyone see the problem with this? It doesn't account for all the firms who might have gone bust or those firms who did not take part in the survey. It also asked them directly after the law had changed and did not trace the long-run effects of the policy. What happened in 1993? What happened in 1994? What about 1995? To conclude anything concrete from minimum wages based on this study is active fraudulence. And yet, sadly, because certain people have the political will to push minimum wages through, it has gained undue importance in the literature on this topic. Do minimum wages cause unemployment?
Our survey said.
But anyway, let's look at some of the stats from Lord Keynes 2. Hall, Walsh and Yates, 2000, report the results of a survey of 654 UK companies in 1995 carried out by the Bank of England, and mostly of large companies in manufacturing, that's 68% of them, as well as in some services and retail and construction. So we can already see that this problem is zooming in on manufacturing. More on that in a moment. The survey found that 79% of firms used time-dependent pricing and reviewed prices at specific frequencies. Furthermore, 28% of companies reviewed their prices only once a year and about 19% only quarterly. About 37% of companies had changed their prices once in the year period before the survey and 27% twice. Okay, what else has he got? The survey also asked firms if they recognized a specific pricing theory as being important for explaining their pricing behavior. The most important results were as follows, and you can see constant marginal costs are right at the top, 53.8%, cost-based pricing, 47.1%, implicit and explicit contracts, 45% and 43%, respectively. And Lord Keynes himself has noted, it should be noted that most important of these theories are compatible, not mutually exclusive. What he's saying there is that they can pick more than one. And, you know, if you adopt cost-based pricing, that's perfectly compatible with constant marginal costs, for example. Anyway, this is Lord Keynes 2. He says, it can be seen that cost-based pricing, market pricing, was the second most important reason given, though it is perfectly compatible with explicit contracts and coordination failure, that is, the failure to raise prices because firms fear competitors will not do so, or lower prices for fear of setting off a price war. The same study points out that when faced with increased demand, 62% of firms increase overtime, whereas only 12% increase the price. Furthermore, other studies show that 66.5% of those firms asked wouldn't lower the price after a demand shock. However, as Lord Keynes II himself notes, price rigidity is a greater phenomenon in manufacturing than in the trade sector. Now, I suspect there is a very good reason for this. Manufacturers are almost all at one level of remove from the people who actually end up buying their goods, namely the consumers. Their actual customers, their immediate customers that is, are either other manufacturers or retailers. As Lord Keynes II himself points out, such firms are often required to make fixed nominal contracts which generally fix prices for the customer. And this is an important reason, as well as cost-based pricing, for price rigidity. But remember, the customer in this case is not you or me, but another company. Let's take a real-world example. Here in the UK, Tesco's are a massive retailer. About 28.3% of all retail purchases in the whole country are from Tesco. Tesco, therefore, has a lot of suppliers. Tesco are famous for promising their customers the lowest prices they can offer with the tagline, "Every little helps." But they also promise their suppliers that they will be paid above cost. It's actually written into their contracts. Now let's just take a single supplier, let's say Hilton Food Group, and put them next to, by far, their biggest customer, Tesco, and think through the incentives of this company. Now note, this scenario I'm about to talk you through has no real data in it, but I'm using it to explain economic theory and to think about why manufacturing companies in particular might not change their prices as often as we'd expect. I'm going to be massively simplifying things for clarity, but I assure you that if you looked for it, the real-world data would back up the general principle that I'm talking about here. You know, here I picked beef and lamb, again, entirely at random, and it's funny how that keeps happening, doesn't it? So anyway, Hilton Food Group are going to sign a contract with Tesco, but it will have certain commitments from both sides. Tesco agreed to buy 2 million units of beef and 2 million units of lamb from Hilton Food Group at wholesale prices of 50 pence per unit and 40 pence per unit respectively. They'll pay them on the 29th of March. So, from Hilton's point of view, we can see they are making 20 pence on every unit of beef and 20 pence on every unit of lamb. They know this in advance since there is a fixed contract. They have to make 2 million units of each type of meat to fulfill the order, and in exchange they get £1.8 million. They can plan very nicely for this quarter since they know ahead of time how much profit they are going to be making. All they have to focus on is fulfilling the order. But from Tesco's point of view, things look quite different. They are buying the beef at 50 pence per unit, which they hope will sell for £1.20 each, netting them a potential 70 pence per unit. Note that unlike Hilton Food Group, who have their contract already, Tesco do not know how many customers will actually buy the beef or the lamb. They have, in fact, taken a £1.8 million gamble that enough people will want to buy beef and lamb to make a return on that investment. In fact, they'd probably run a number of projections for the coming quarter. A best case scenario, which is that they sell out completely of beef and lamb every week at full price. Let's say a bad scenario where they only sell half of all of the stock. They're still making a profit, but disappointing profit. And then finally, the absolute doomsday scenario where they make a loss on the beef and the lamb. In fact, to stave off simply wasting the stock, you all know what would happen in reality. Tesco's would very quickly put the meat on sale. They'd rather try to claw back 30 pence of profit than get zero. So let's pretend, when all is said and done, that these are the actual sales at the end of the quarter. They've come in making just over £1 million on beef and lamb. And you can see they've ended up selling less than half of the meat at full price, but managed to shift at least a quarter of it at the reduced sale price. However, as you can see, they ended up throwing away over 1 million units. So perhaps they overordered by 1 million units. So let's get into the Q2 negotiations with the Hilton Food Group. Tesco works out that they need to reduce their beef and lamb orders by 500,000 units each. So they put in a smaller order for this quarter. Now pretend that you're the Hilton Food Group here. Tesco are your biggest customer by a mile. You're making around 25% less profit this quarter because demand has dropped, demand from Tesco. Do you drop your price to try to tell Tesco that they need to buy more beef or more lamb? Tesco just had a quarter in which they threw away over 1 million units of beef and lamb. But they know they can sell around 3 million units either at their full price or their special reduced price. So they don't necessarily want to change the price, they just want to order fewer units. They aren't really in the market for more beef or more lamb, so trying to reduce the price to induce Tesco's is not worth it at this point. Also, if you really annoy Tesco's, they can walk away and go with another competitor, and your Q2 profits will suddenly be very close to zero. Tesco has a lot of leverage here. In fact, supermarkets are notorious for squeezing their suppliers. So Hilton Foods simply sign to sell a smaller amount of beef and lamb for the same prices as last quarter. Now, in the longer term, if sales of beef really slump, then eventually Tesco would likely push them to lower the price. First, they'd have to reduce their own prices after they noticed that demand for beef was down 30%. This would induce them to then demand a lower price from the supplier in the next contract negotiation. They're going to try to use their leverage to push for a lower price, wholesale price. And this in turn would cause the supplier to try to cut their costs somewhere, either by letting go of workers or shutting down parts of the operation. If this new reality produced an increase in demand, then eventually Tesco might consider sneaking that price back up, and eventually the supplier might even be brave enough to ask Tesco to go back to their old rate. Now, to the post-Keynesian macroeconomist who is not looking at the full picture like this, they can zoom in on any given year here and say, oh look, there was nominal price rigidity there. The supplier did not adjust their prices in response to fluctuating demand. But of course, there's always going to be a delay in the supply chain, especially when they are signing quarterly contracts, as in this case. In fact, the post-Keynesian, looking at 2020 in isolation, would see the same thing. But as you can see, this in no way invalidates standard price theory as they seem to think. There's just a lag effect. Ultimately, the supplier must respond to consumer demand, even though it is at a level of remove from it. Now get out.